Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome to the program that helps you learn American English. At the same time, you will hear about important events taking place around the world. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. It's nice to have you with us. Today, two serious stories. First, information about the drug trade between Pakistan and Afghanistan and its connection to terrorism. Then we will introduce you to the human side of conflict, as we meet people whose lives have been affected by the troubles in Ukraine. As It is coming to you from Washington. Pakistan and Afghanistan are working together to fight terrorism and increase security along their common border. And some experts hope this kind of cooperation will lead to more effective efforts against the drug trade. Many nations have worked together to fight illegal drug production in Afghanistan. But the United Nations recently reported another increase in the amount of Afghan land used to grow opium poppy plants. Drug dealers use poppy plants to make the drug opium. Pakistani officials are concerned about both the increase in Afghan drugs and plans to withdraw most NATO forces from Afghanistan. The officials say the two developments make it difficult for them to fight the drug trade. Major General Hawar Hanif is the head of Pakistan's anti-narcotics force. He says the international community must continue working together to fight the Afghan drug problem. He spoke at a recent international conference in Islamabad.
Thankfully, the commitment of the present Afghan government with respect to border control arrangements and counter-narcotic efforts is quite palpable. However, we believe that unless there is a wholehearted support from the international community proportionate to the drug problem, the region is going to remain in the same crisis. Abandoning our Afghan colleagues to deal with this overwhelming poppy cultivation and drug production is not an option at all.
Pakistan shares a 2,500-kilometer border with Afghanistan. Most of it is unguarded. General Hanif says the largely open territory makes it difficult for Pakistan to stop terrorism and drug trafficking. Pakistan and Afghanistan have exchanged high-level military officials. The exchanges are part of joint efforts to improve security and deal with militants involved in attacks on both sides of the border. Cesar Gudis is the representative for the UN Anti-Drug Office in Pakistan. He says joint efforts are needed to fight the drug trade in the area.
I think that is the key element for success in combating drugs trafficking in this part of the world. The main producing country plus the main transit country need to strengthen their efforts effectively, very professionally, and with all the sectors in both countries joining efforts to tackle this regional problem.
Mr. Gudis says illegal drugs from Afghanistan are commonly sold in Europe. He says the drugs are often shipped through Pakistan.
It's approximately 45 to 50% of the opiates produced in Afghanistan that use Pakistan as a preferred stepping stone on Western international market. Then about 30% goes via the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the balance 20-something percent. Via the Central Asian republics onwards to Russia and Europe.
Pakistani officials say the increased production of Afghan drugs has also led to an increase in drug use among Pakistanis. You are listening to the Voice of America. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Hundreds of thousands of people in eastern Ukraine have fled their homes to escape fighting between government forces and Russian-supported rebels. Most are in government-controlled parts of the two eastern districts that the rebels claim. Under international law, they are called internally displaced persons, but they call themselves refugees. VOA visited a group of these refugees at a church just 40 kilometers from the front lines of the conflict. As we hear from Kelly Jean Kelly, the refugees believe the building is a safe place for them.
One of the refugees is named Paul. He is the leader of a different church. He fled the rebel-controlled Donetsk city early in the conflict.
I left in the end of June because it was quite strange situation. It was difficult to express, danger to express my point of view. It was a danger for my life.
Many of the refugees in the church lived in small towns and villages before the Ukrainian Revolution took place a year ago. Shortly after the revolution, Russian President Vladimir Putin supported an uprising in eastern Ukraine. Many people there feel closer to Russia and fear what will happen if Ukraine continues to become politically closer to Western nations. The people VOA interviewed all speak Russian and are from eastern Ukraine, but they do not feel close to Russia. We spoke to a woman named Nadezhda, a church worker. She says she brought her 90-year-old mother to the church the day before we spoke to her. She says during the night, an artillery shell landed near their home, causing great destruction. Galina is a social worker. She says she saw the explosions and the shelling. She says she was afraid to sleep at night. She worried that if she slept, the house would blow up. The fighting in eastern Ukraine has also affected the children who were forced to flee quickly with their families. They attend new schools and must try to make new friends. They say they miss the friends and family members they were once close to. Anya is a student who fled the conflect. She says she talks, when she can, with her friends in the city she fled. But, she says, her friends often do not have telephone service or electricity. She says they struggle to recharge their phones. She says when she is able to talk with them, they tell her there is shelling every day. In the safety of Artemivsk, the refugees try to make new friends. Galina, the social worker, says they are given food and clothes. She says they fled wearing only summer clothes, like shorts and T-shirts, but now they have winter clothes. She says it is nice that the world is thinking about them. Olga is a music teacher. She says the children are going to school and taking music lessons. She says the adults are trying to help the children live normal lives, similar to the ones they had before they fled the fighting. But they fear that the rebels will force them to flee again. The rebels are nearby. They are supported by Russian troops, supplies, and training. The church worker named Nadezhda says she cannot accept the idea of the rebels coming because, in her words, they are destroying our people and our land. It is not right, she says. It is not fair. The refugees say they hope to go home someday. But peace talks between Ukraine's government and the rebels ended after just a few hours on Saturday, and each side criticizes the other. Pressure is also growing for the West to provide military weapons to the Ukrainian army. So the refugees will probably stay where they are for a long time. If the fighting reaches Artemivsk, they may be forced to flee even farther west. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Jim Tedder at the VOA studios in Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. Recently, a Chinese regulatory agency said that most of the goods sold on the Chinese website Alibaba are counterfeit. That means the products are not made by the company that is claimed to be the maker. Alibaba is a website that connects buyers with sellers. The company's chief, Jack Ma, says he has solved the dispute with Chinese officials. China's Alibaba Group has become a major internet company in a short amount of time. Last year, the company raised $25 billion in its IPO, or initial public offering. The company offered stock shares to the public for the first time last September on the New York Stock Exchange. But recently, China's State Administration of Industry and Commerce, SAIC, released a report that said the company has not done enough to stop the internet sales of illegal goods. Alibaba's executive chairman, Jack Ma, said this was not true.
We were misunderstood by the world that we are not transparent. We don't want misunderstood by the world that Taobao is a platform of selling fake products. And we want this company is always, I said, not represent China internet. It represents the spirit of internet of the whole world.
The SAIC report said that Alibaba employees took bribes and permitted merchants to sell illegal wine, handbags, and other goods without the required license. It also said an investigation showed that many of the samples on the Taobao retail website were not licensed products. Alibaba runs Taobao. On January 27th, Taobao rejected the study's findings. The company said the study was unfair. The next day, the SAIC released information about a July meeting between its representatives and Alibaba officials. In the meeting, the SAIC informed Alibaba that counterfeit goods were being sold through the website. The agency also told the company that it had violated marketing rules and had a poor consumer rating system. Later, however, tensions between regulators and Alibaba appeared to ease. The SAIC and Taobao both removed the materials from their websites. For many years now, Western companies have accused companies in China of stealing intellectual property and selling illegal products. In recent years, the government has taken steps to deal with those concerns. This week, Jack Ma spoke in Hong Kong. He said that the company will be open in its dealings with the legal action. He said the situation should give Western observers a better understanding of Alibaba and China. And that's the economics report from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the spring of 1865, the American Civil War was over, and the president who had led the Union during that war was dead. Abraham Lincoln had been murdered before the final surrender of Confederate forces. Now, the reunited nation had a new president, Andrew Johnson. He had been Lincoln's vice president. The Chief Justice of the United States swore Johnson into office a few hours after Lincoln's death. Most of Lincoln's cabinet was there, together with leading members of Congress. They looked to the new president with a mixture of shock and hope. This week in our series, Shep O'Neill and Tony Riggs begin the story of America's 17th president.
Andrew Johnson was, like Abraham Lincoln, a man of the people. He was born in North Carolina. His family was poor. There was no money or time for young Andrew to go to school. When he was 14 years old, his mother sent him to work for a tailor to learn to make clothes. Andrew worked hard. He opened his own tailoring business in the eastern part of the state of Tennessee. When he was 18, he married. His wife, Eliza, taught him to read and write.
Andrew became active in politics. At the age of 21, he was elected to the town council. 2 years later, he became mayor of the town. At 35, he won a seat in Congress in Washington. Next, he became governor of Tennessee. Then the state made him one of its two senators. The poor tailor boy was a success.
Andrew Johnson was a member of the Democratic Party. In the presidential election of 1860, he supported his party's candidate, not the candidate of the Republican Party, Abraham Lincoln. But Lincoln won the election, and, as a result, Southern states carried out their earlier threat. They began leaving the Union to form their own nation. Johnson opposed this secession. He believed the South should remain part of the United States. He decided he had no choice but to support the Republican president. Most of the other citizens in Tennessee disagreed with him. They decided to leave the Union. Andrew Johnson had to flee his home to save his life. He returned only after Union forces took control of Tennessee and made him military governor.
President Lincoln noticed the man from Tennessee who supported the Union over the opposition of others. In 1864, Lincoln decided to run for re-election. He chose Johnson to be his vice presidential candidate. Lincoln hoped Johnson would win the support of Union-loving Democrats. He hoped Johnson would help heal the wounds between North and South. Now, Lincoln was dead, and Johnson was president. It was up to this little-known former tailor to make the decisions on Reconstruction, on rebuilding the Union. Johnson, not Lincoln, would decide if Reconstruction would be easy or hard. Johnson would choose if the North would punish the defeated rebel states or be merciful to them.
The radicals of Lincoln's Republican Party wanted severe Reconstruction. They said the South was a defeated enemy. They demanded strong punishment for all Southerners who took part in the rebellion. These radicals had disliked Lincoln's plans for Reconstruction. They felt he was too weak. Now, they hoped Johnson would share their ideas. They urged him to call a special session of Congress to pass strong legislation against the South. The radicals had reason to believe the new president agreed with them. He had called the rebels traitors. He had demanded strong action against them when the war ended. "The time has come," Johnson had said, "when the American people should understand what crime is, and that it should be punished."
But Andrew Johnson surprised the radicals. He did not call the special session of Congress. Instead, he announced his own program for the Southern states. Johnson declared a pardon for all former Confederates who promised to support the Union and obey laws against slavery. Then he permitted former officials of the Confederacy to run for office in their state's new elections. Many of these former rebels were elected. The radical Republicans were angry. They saw these elections as proof that the South had not really changed. They accused Johnson of being too soft. They urged him to punish the rebels. One radical newspaper wrote, "There is only one sure and safe policy for the immediate future. The North must remain the dictator of the Republic until the spirit of the North shall become the spirit of the whole country. The South's treason is still unpunished. Southerners cannot be trusted."
The radicals also worried about what would happen to the recently freed slaves. They said the new state governments of the South would not treat blacks as free and equal citizens. As proof, they pointed to new laws the Southern legislatures passed. For example, the state legislature in Mississippi said no black person could rent farmland. It said a black person needed special permission to work at any job except farming. Mississippi also passed a law saying a black person could be forced to work for a white man, usually his former owner, if he had no other job. Another way the state governments in the South acted against blacks was by refusing to give them the right to vote.
The radical Republicans decided that President Johnson's Reconstruction program must be stopped. They began working to get control of Congress, to pass their own program. Only by gaining political power could they punish the South and guarantee full political rights to former slaves. The radicals tried to take control in two ways. First, they refused to let many of the recently elected Southern congressmen take their seats when Congress opened. Then they formed their own Joint Committee on Reconstruction. This committee, not the Senate or the House of Representatives, would make many of the decisions about Reconstruction.
Radical lawmakers took other steps to seize control of Reconstruction efforts in the South. Congress had established a government agency to take care of black refugees in the South. The agency gave food and clothing to former slaves who had no food, money, or jobs. It began to teach them to read and write. Republicans in Congress moved to extend the life of the agency and increase its powers. They passed a bill and sent it to the White House for the president's approval. President Johnson vetoed the bill. He said it would create false hopes among former slaves. He also said it was unconstitutional. The radicals tried to overturn Johnson's veto. However, they failed to get the necessary votes.
Congress passed several other bills giving the federal government power to protect the rights of blacks in the southern states. President Johnson vetoed these bills, too. He said they interfered with the rights of the states. These defeats made the radicals even more angry. Their newspapers began a steady attack against the president and his policy toward the South. Some even accused him of treason.
Many Americans agreed with this criticism of President Johnson. They gave the radicals a big victory in congressional elections of 1866. Radical leaders gained the power to pass any bill they wished, even over the president's veto. And they wasted no time doing just that. Time after time, they voted to overturn Andrew Johnson's vetoes. The atmosphere in Washington became very tense. Relations between Congress and the White House sank to their lowest level in history. The political skies darkened. Soon, the radicals tried something that had never been tried before. They tried to remove the president from office. The conflict between the radicals and Andrew Johnson would provide some of the most historic and intense moments in American history. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
Our program was written by David Jarmel and Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Shep O'Neill and Tony Riggs. Transcripts, podcasts, and historical images from our series are at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also comment on our programs, and we invite you to follow us on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.